Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the new screensavers is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. The new screensavers is brought to you by WordPress. Reach more customers when you build your business website on WordPress.com. Plans start at just $4 a month. Get 15% off any new plan purchase at WordPress.com/NSS.
GDPR explained. Staying connected while on vacation, and the last time Padre will co-host the show. Live from the Twit Studios in Petaluma, California, it's the new Screensavers!
Maximus Decimus.
So say something to him in Latin, like pro bono.
I could do the Latin mass for him, but it might take a while.
Pro bono, Max. This is the new Screensavers episode 157, recorded Saturday, May 19th, 2018. Leo Laporte on this end.
Father Robert Ballister over here.
Is it really your last new Screensavers?
It really is. But, I mean, we say last knowing that the world is actually a lot smaller now. It'll be the last time while I'm still a contract employee of Twit.
You're going back to Rome in June.
I have to go to Portland first because I have to remember that thing I did last year.
You know, when I go to Rome, I always stop in Portland too.
It's crossroads. It's the crossroads. But no, I'll be
so
there.
So you
for
have
a
to go and
half.
Do your. You're doing your what we call the tertianship.
The tertianship, right?
Which is unique to the Society of Jesuits, which mm-hmm. Father Robert is in the Society of Jesuits, Society of Jesus, which is the Jesuits. And so the tertianship is something you do before you take your final vows.
Correct.
To prove to yourself that you're all in on this thing.
Right, and then right after that we get jumped in. I get the secret tattoo and my dagger, which is awesome.
I want the Jesuit dagger. The dagger of power.
On the next
know-how. So are you going to do another month of silence?
No. So this last year was the silence. So this year it's quiet but not silence. I will be in silence for 8 days of that month and a half, 2 months. But the rest of the time, I can communicate just fine.
Nice.
Yeah,
nice.
I probably won't, though, because I really like the silence.
So you're gonna, yeah, I know. Great. I would like to be silent for 5 or 6 minutes myself. haven't been able to do it yet. So you go to Portland, and then you go to Rome when?
Then I go to Rome. So I will come back here. I actually do have one last twit with you.
Oh, good.
Literally the day before I jump on a plane and...
Oh, and we'll give you the final rites at that time.
Right. I'll bring in the Asperges and just hose down the studio. Everything will be cool.
No, I'm excited for you. He's going back to Rome. He's been called back. But I know you told me that you're hoping to build a studio there in the Vatican.
I've got the space. I've got the permission. So I just have to finish building it out. It could take a while. I've been told things move a little differently in Italy.
Well, it's because it's Italy.
It's Italy.
It's Italian builders.
Lots of permissions.
Long
that you
lunch.
Have to get. Yeah, but it'll be fun. You know, it's a new step. It's a new stage. It's something that I have to do for the church. But it doesn't mean that I'm going to disappear. You'll see me.
No. In fact, I'm really looking forward to it. I have a feeling you'll be doing stuff from the Vatican for us, and I think that's really going to be cool. Mm-hmm. So we'll keep you posted. But this is technically the last time for the new Screensavers, so enjoy it. Coming up, we've got a great show for you. You probably, I just logged onto Twitter, and I got the GDPR notice. You're getting a barrage of terms of service emails in your inbox. Everybody from Facebook to Google to Twitter is changing the rules of privacy. So this is all because of the General Data Protection Regulation that goes into effect on Friday, the 25th. Danny O'Brien is going to join us from the Electronic Frontier Foundation to help us understand. There's two points of view, what it means for consumers, but also what it means for developers, small business people.
Us.
You and me. It couldn't, you know, in terms of how you behave on the internet might change some things.
There's one thing I really like about the switchover, and that is all the emails I'm getting from the spam company saying, we really want you to opt in, and I just kind of gleefully delete.
Yeah. And a couple of companies have already decided we're just going to go out of business. Or I imagine you'll see this too, block all European users, which that's a fairly draconian
thing. That's a big chunk of the world.
Now, remember, Google decided it didn't want to do business in China because China asked it to do some things it wasn't comfortable with. Apple, on the other hand, this is one of our top stories of the week. Oh, but I shouldn't get to that yet. We'll go to that in a second. First, I'm sorry. I gave you one thing coming up on the show.
Hint, a little hint.
That's going to be news in a little bit. After this last week's segment on 360 cameras with DP Review, Dale Baskin, remember, recommended the Rylo, and I decided to go the other way. I have the GoPro Fusion, and we'll take a look at the pros.
And it's not in the case, by the way. It looks like that when it's in operation.
Yeah, no, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
But you know why you keep it in the case? Because the lens has no protection at all. And if you put it, your temptation would be to put it down, right?
And you'll scratch that lens.
Put it on the lens. So you almost have to keep it in the case. I've seen people sell little rubber lens caps and stuff because, Alex Lindsay stopped me. He said, no! I was starting to put it down. He said, no! what else we have coming up?
Oh, we have to talk about Securus because, I mean, Securus is going to be crazy. That's going to be a little hot topic. But also, we've got a call for help about securing your own network. I'm kind of going to like that.
Yeah. Now that Memorial Day and summer is around the corner, Megan Maroney has some outdoor gadget picks, speakers, cameras, even a kit for washing your car.
No, seriously.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool.
And I have another. I actually have two reviews. I'm also going to review the orange hockey puck of Wi-Fi.
I am very much interested in knowing how this worked because I'm going to be in a lot of places where I'll need worldwide connectivity.
This is an example of something I got because people asked us about it, and I thought, well, I better take a look at this and review it. It's called a Skyroam Solus. Jason Hauer has a MIDI controller that's a form of a giant guitar, apparently really giant, and we got some call for help. But let's start with those hot topics. I'm going to mention this China thing because it just broke, and I'm kind of curious. Apparently, there is something available. You know how Apple, in its SDKs, its developer kits, offers a variety of things. There's AR kit, which allows you to do augmented reality. There's something called Call Kit, which allows you to do video calls. Apparently, Apple is now starting to pull applications out of the App Store in China only that use Call Kit.
Yep.
And this is not because there's anything wrong with Call Kit, but because the Chinese government asked them to. This is yet another crackdown on dissidents. And, this is where the question comes up. Do you do what Google did and say, look, there's a line too far, a bridge too far? Or do you do what Apple seems to do every single time and say, well, whatever you want, we want to keep doing business in China? I mean, the alternative is not being in China.
Right, exactly. And Apple sees that as too big of a market. They know that they've kind of filled everything that they're going to fill over here in the United States. They'll sell the regular allotment of phones, but if they want to grow, it's all about China. They have to get China, and so they're willing to bend over backwards to try to get that little extra market penetration. But we should make it clear to people what this means. The reason why China doesn't want this feature available is because you can encrypt it. And if you can encrypt it, it means that's something that they can't actually get visibility into. So what they've really asked Apple, which is the same thing they asked Google, is, we want to see what everyone who's using one of your devices is doing in our country.
Right.
Google said, no, we can't do that. Apple said, okay, I guess that's the cost of doing business.
And the thing, I don't know where Apple draws the line. If very famously, Yahoo in China, when it was asked by the Chinese government to hand over emails from Chinese dissidents, did. Those dissidents ended up in jail.
BlackBerry did that once, too, back in their day.
A number of governments, including the Russian government, asked BlackBerry for the source code to the BlackBerry server so that, presumably, they could monitor traffic on the server. Companies generally say, okay, it's the law of the land. We're going to do business in this country. We've got to obey the law of the land. I guess, really, your only choice is to withdraw from the country. And I kind of wish Apple would take a stand here.
I wish they had a backbone, because it seems a little inconsistent. 2 years ago, when they stood up and they said, look, we know that our phone might contain data back in San Bernardino that law enforcement might really want. They didn't want the slippery slope of giving the government a tool that could break into all their phones. And I could kind of cheer them on for this, but then they do this, and it seems so incongruent. It's like, wait a minute, so if the U.S. government asks you for this, no. But if the Chinese government asks you, Sure, whatever you want.
That bugs me.
That does bug me.
That bugs me.
Yeah.
All right. Nothing more to say about it. That's just the way it is. What were the other stories?
You said Securus. Okay,
tell me. So Securus is a company. All right. Already I don't like it because their business is selling phone service to inmates at exorbitant prices.
Yes.
And at the same time, when they're doing that, they provide access to the phone calls to the prison.
To law enforcement.
Now, of course, if you're a prisoner, you don't have the right to have an unmonitored phone call. I understand
Unless
that.
It's with your lawyer. Unless it's with your
right.
lawyer, then you do.
I understand that. It's all right. It's already a sleazy business because they really charge through the nose for these phone calls. All right.
It's worse than that, though, Leo.
What?
Because it's worse than just a sleazy company. So what they did was they created a portal that would allow, according to the way they sold it, law enforcement officials to track basically any phone, 95% of all the phones in the United States and Canada.
Now, we should point out that's with the cooperation of AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, and Verizon,
right,
who are putting that stuff online, and Securus is just aggregating that information, right?
Well, there was a special permission that had to be granted because the level of raw data that they have from the carriers suggests that this is more than just an API that they're hitting, because they can track pretty much every phone in real time. So they have AT&T, T-Mobile, Verizon, who am I missing? Sprint, at least. At least those, and also a couple in Canada.
We'll be missing Sprint, all of us, soon.
Precisely. But with this data, they were allowed to create this portal that supposedly only law enforcement could use. Some people just stumbled across it, and they realized they could use it,
Anybody
too.
Could use
Anyone
it.
Anyone could use it. Now, they've locked down that part of the site because they've said it's our bad. But now you've got Senator Wyden, who has written an open letter to the FCC, essentially saying, why was this company allowed to have this data in the first place?
Right.
This makes no sense, especially since the company has no checks and balances. They had a sheriff in Mississippi who used this service, because he's law enforcement, to illegally track other law enforcement offices and a judge in his district. Well, there was no warrant.
Right.
There was no bit of legislation that he was using to be able to do that legally, and Securus had nothing to protect against that. So this is one of these things where it's a big data company that is doing something interesting. It's just doing it in a horribly, horribly insecure way.
It really is. And you saw Brian Krebs asking everybody to retweet. It is not okay for cell phone companies to sell our location data to the highest bidder or to a commercial company or any third party without, I would hope, a court order or a subpoena. But you should also understand the law of the land is that this is so-called pen register, which does not require a warrant for metadata. And as of now, that location data
that
is considered metadata.
No, but, you know, Leo, the thing that bothers me the most about this, because, you know, in the enterprise side, we've known about this for a while. They've been using dirt boxes and ISMI catchers for the longest time to do this sort of work. This is just sort of now it's easy to do. My biggest concern has been the lack of outrage from the average person. There seems to be this, they're tracking me through social media. They already know where my phone is. It doesn't really matter if they're using RFID radio triangulation to figure out my exact location.
Right.
And that bothers me because it means people don't actually understand that's protected. That's a constitutional right against due process, against search and seizure.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe it's a good thing I'm moving to Rome.
Oh, yeah, it's so much better there. The church won't know anything about
I you. Run the system, so I can just erase my logs. It's cool.
Anyway, we thought we'd raise your interest in it. If you want to read more, you saw that Ars Technica article. Dan Gooden, of course, writes great stuff about security, and that'd be a good place to go. Friday is May 25th. That is a very important day in internet privacy. It is the day that the General Data Protection Regulation from the EU finally goes into effect. They passed this law in 2016, but they wanted everybody to have enough time to get ready for it.
Which no one used. No, everyone is panicking, right? It's like every other law that
Isn't
has a
funny?
Long runway.
All these notices are coming out like now. Like, oh!
It's like, wait, you've had this for 2 years, right?
So, we're going to change our policies. You know, it's so complicated, and it really has different implications for end users than from companies. We thought we'd get somebody who knows what he's talking about on. Danny O'Brien, he is the international director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Did you just lose him?
There we go.
Oh,
there's Danny.
Oh, hey, Danny. How are you?
Hey.
So, you know, it's funny. This is GDPR is on one hand, the kind of things we've been calling for, you know, real strong data protection with, by the way, a very severe penalty, up to 4% of your global revenue. Now, it only impacts...
Or 20 million, depending which is larger.
At least 20 million euros or your 4% of your entire revenue. In my case, 20 million euros. So so it's a significant penalty. But what's unknown is how they're going to enforce it, how assiduously they're going to enforce it, who's going to be liable. Apparently, though, this affects anybody who does business with end users in the EU, right?
Yeah. So the regulation applies to people who are in the EU, not just the EU citizens. That could be anyone. If you're in on holiday, if you're in Rome, you will be protected by the GDPR.
But wait, is the Vatican in the EU?
Oh, good question.
I think I'm immune.
Do they use lira or euros?
We have our own stuff. We call them Pope bucks.
Pope bucks.
You won't be protected in your house, but if you nip down the road to get a packet of papers or something like that, then you'll be it's geographical in that sense. Of course, any big company and anyone who's offering a service to a European also gets covered by this.
Now, this is one of these things that we've been pushing for on our enterprise show, the ability to have real penalties. Because, for example, when Hilton Hotels had a huge leak, they basically said meh because the penalty was $100,000. That's not even a slap on the wrist. That's the change left on the couch. So this is to put teeth into making sure that businesses protect the data that the users are giving them. In fact, one of the taglines for the GDPR has been to remind companies that it's my data, not yours.
Right.
I like the idea that regulations now have film movie mottos,
right?
In a world with data
coming soon.
So the thing to remember is actually the EU has had these kind of laws since 1995. In fact, it's just that no one in the wider world—well, maybe no one, but certainly, say Facebook—paid much attention to them. So this was definitely them attempting to learn their lesson from trying to get these big companies to comply with these rules in the past. And the rules are sort of refined and a bit sharpened, but the basic principles are still there.
So, for instance, in the case of, and I like this one, in the case of a data breach, companies have 72 hours
3 days
to let everybody affected know about it.
I've definitely spoken to companies who are freaking out about that because 72 hours, the clock is ticking, and sometimes you're still in the middle of trying to work out what happened, how much access you have. But in many ways, that's so much better than when you find out sort of 5 years down the line, someone just mentions it in there because they're being bought by another company, and it's part of their due diligence. They have to say, we lost everybody's data.
But then there's things that are a little bit more tricky. For instance, it requires that anybody in the EU can ask the company to delete any of their private data. And that may be challenging. And there's also a question of what is private data? Is an IP address private data?
Mm-hmm. So this is the right of erasure. And we try and call it the right of erasure because there's also the right to be forgotten. And that's kind of enough. I mean, they're sort of connected, but people freak out more about the right to be forgotten than the right of erasure. And yes, this does give you the capability to go in. First of all, you can get to see the data that people have got on you.
And so already Facebook's implemented that. That's actually kind of cool.
Right.
You could download all your Facebook data. That's great.
And also, you can go, if you go to Twitter's profile these days, you can go onto that and you can see not only what they sort of know about you in terms of your you know, where you are, if you turned on location data, that kind of thing, but also what advertisers think you like, which is super interesting. And the funny thing about this is that you immediately look through it. It thought that I really liked a particular brand of skin lotion, and I don't know whether you can see here, but that's not my thing.
You might like it, but you don't use it.
And I went there to click that off, and I went, oh, this is interesting because this is a GDPR power. I now have to correct that. But of course, this is great for advertisers, so maybe this will turn out to be good for even the people who are most freaking out.
Yeah, because they don't want to waste money advertising skin lotion to you.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, some improvement. But the important thing here is that I know a lot of technical people are freaking out because You know, right of erasure is hard. Like, if you're doing backups,
right?
Or, hey, and I'm going to say the word, so I probably need to be forgiven here. If you're using the blockchain, then
you can't.
That's permanent. Yep. Like, how can you delete what's going on? And those sort of questions are going to be sorted out by the regulators and in the European courts, I think, in the next few months and even years. Like, what does it mean to really accurately erase something?
You know, I have to think about this as the owner of Twit. We don't collect information about our audience, but except we do, because every time you visit the website, we have your IP address.
Because we have to dedupe. That's part of our business model.
And if you send me email, I have your email address and your IP address of your server. So even though I don't actively collect this information, I have no use for it, I got to figure out a way to stop collecting it or give you a way to delete it and to disclose, right? Those are the three things, yeah.
And I think there's something powerful there because, I mean, for over a decade now, I've been like on my dog and pony show as an EFF spokesperson, and I go out to, you know, MySQL conferences and things like that, and just go, don't be a pack rat, right? Like, if you're gonna collect this data, collect it for a reason. And that's a really hard thing for my fellow geeks to hear, right? Because we're all pack rats. We're all like, hey, I've got like a terabyte here. I can just store this. Who knows?
Like, we like logs because if something goes wrong, we can at least look at the log.
From the enterprise side, that's what I'm really concerned about, which is my industry builds equipment with the sole purpose of capturing data. Because we use that data to make the networks better. If now we have to have some sort of bureaucracy in place to say, well, we're going to remove this single IP address, or how close does it actually have to be to the user for them to consider it their data, that's going to paralyze the IT industry.
Well, I think that there's a couple of different points of view on this, and this is kind of interesting to see how this will play out. The first thing is that a lot of the time, the reason why this is kind of hard is just because the defaults are set up in certain ways, right? So if you're installing Apache or something like that, it just assumes you want everything. EFF, we actually wrote a patch for Apache. There's some meta level going on there. To anonymize but not sort of remove the uniqueness of IP addresses, basically take out and hash like one of the quartets in it. And that's what we use to try and protect privacy. And that's the sort of thing that you'll see appearing in these pieces of software to make them more GDPR compliant. So you should still be able to do the network stuff. And there's words in the GDPR that says, look, if you absolutely need to do this, then you know, we're not going to be insane about this. What we'll wait to see is exactly what happens now, because I think there's this really tight line between people overreacting and over enthusiastic regulators who don't quite understand how it works saying, actually, we really mean it, do this, and also the risk of a backlash. And that backlash isn't going to come from Facebook and Google so much because they don't have the sort of voice in Europe that they might have in Washington, D.C., but it will come from people like the big European media companies because their business model is now connected to Google Ads, right? Like, if you're going to the Spiegel or something like that, those ads are still being sold by Google. And if they can't show those ads because of the GDPR, actually big European companies with influence in Brussels are going to start, you have to water this down.
How do you see this playing out? Because obviously there's going to be a test case. At some point, they're going to single some company out, and we're all going to hold our breaths and see, okay, how are they actually going to prosecute it? What are they going to do with the fines? Is this just going to be a warning? Do you think they'll start with a large multinational like Google or Amazon? Or are they going to start local, something actually in the EU, and say, look, we want to start small, and we just want to show you the error of your ways. Now do better and be along.
Yeah, I heard it was you guys. I thought
we're the test case.
I mean, you admitted that you were struggling. So interestingly, this one of the big changes that they made in the GDPR is slightly to take this out of the regulators' hands. So one of the reasons people felt that the pre-GDPR wasn't being enforced against Facebook is a lot of these companies are based for tax reasons in Ireland. In the EU, and Ireland's data protection authority was kind of, you know, they kind of dragged their heels a little bit. And, you know, they actually had to be taken to court before they would start taking some of these complaints seriously. So in the new GDPR, actually, individuals and nonprofits, like the sort of European equivalent of the EFF, can take this into their own hands. And in fact, if you guys remember Max Schrems, who was actually the person that took the Irish DPA to court, Max is actually based in Austria, and he started a really fascinating nonprofit called None of Your Business. And I'm pretty sure that they're ready to go on Friday with a whole set of, you know, reports to the regulator to really shake out where the lines are with this new law.
That raises an interesting question. So the regulator can go after a company, but can an individual also use GDPR to go after a company?
So this is part of the GDPR that we're going to have to wait and see. So one of the things that the Europeans liked about the American model for privacy was actually class actions. The idea that a bunch of people could get together and say, actually, you violated my rights. And even though, you know, there's no regulator doing this, we're going to take matters into our own hands. So in the GDPR, there was sort of a construction that kind of drew a kind of class action-like system. But that actually has to be written into individual European state laws. And what that might mean is that somewhere in Austria, the Austrian state might be a better place to launch these lawsuits than, say, Italy, that might decide to go against that. So part of what's going on here is we're going to see all the different European states, all of whom have a very different ideas about privacy. In Britain, you have people just, you know, having CCTV cameras sticking out of their top hats or bowlers or whatever.
That's what they were wearing
when I left. Yeah. Compared to Germany, where is like actually like extremely privacy conscious.
Yeah, they wanted Google to blur buildings in the street view because they didn't want you to see the front of the building.
And so if the German model of privacy takes hold, I think that's going to be great for really strong privacy protections, but it might make it a lot harder for companies to comply.
How hard-ass is the European Commission going to be? That's really the question at this point. Are they going to, I mean, because nobody, there's so much unknown, there's so much in flux. Are they going to really enforce this to the T, or are they going to gradually go into it and give companies a chance to think about it and learn and say, oh, yeah, okay. Like, if for instance, if I showed goodwill, I know they're not going to go after me, but if I, let's say I'd be a subject, if I showed the goodwill, like I'm trying to do something, but I didn't do it perfectly, are they going to be understanding?
It's interesting you should say the European Commission, because one of the dynamics here is that the EU is a pretty young multi-state. And in fact, a lot of these institutions are still developing the balances that you read in the history books in the US, right? The European Court of Justice is beginning to feel its oats. The Commission kind of wants to protect business. And then you have these regulators, the data protection regulators, and they're like Thanos right now, right? Right. They've just got like
Margareta Vestager, right? Who is in charge of this, seems to be very adamant about all of this.
Absolutely, we've been linking to articles, and those articles, like, you know, read like we wrote them. You know, like they've got this, like, you know, you guys better watch out. I think what's going to happen. I do think that the regulators do have a tendency in the EU, you know, in this situation historically, of going, look, we understand, like, you weren't like setting out to do something egregious here. And also, I do think there's a chance that if this really does bite into companies and also open source developers, right, like, because they're also trying to think this through. If there are groups that the European institutions feel that they have to represent and, you know, represent the interests of, then there's going to be some moderating or even watering down of this. The big question, and I think this is what you see in a lot of the coverage in the US, is is that kind of generosity going to extend to Silicon Valley companies?
Right.
Because the relations between Silicon Valley and the EU have not been good for a while. They've been very upset about Cambridge Analytica and fake news and all of that. They've been very concerned about what they view as sort of tax avoidance.
Right.
These companies don't pay a lot of taxes. And, you know, they're not huge employers compared to many other industries in the European Union. In many cases, you know, companies like Facebook have maybe a programming group, maybe an advertising team or something like that. So there could be some real political interest in showing who's boss to these headline companies.
If they do selective prosecution where they're singling out just U.S. companies that they've had beefs with in the past, specifically with Google, which already got into trouble with the EU over their newsreader program, there's going to be significant backlash on this side of the pond.
But what backlash? What could we do? You can't say, oh, well, we're just not going to serve Germany, France, and Italy.
But
you can't do that.
That's what Google did. With their newsreader, they said, fine, we'll go home.
They did it in Spain. They stopped linking to publications in Spain, and they collapsed pretty quickly.
Well, actually, what happened is that the publishers went to the EU and are actually proposing in a new copyright directive that we actually have an action on right now to expand that new snippet tax effectively licensing regime to the whole of the EU.
Oh, wow.
And I actually spoke to the European Parliamentary Committee who were considering this, and I said, look, it didn't work in Spain. And they went, well, that's probably because it wasn't big enough.
Oh, Lord.
So we do run this risk of a sort of like internecine war between countries. But I actually feel that that's something that we're seeing in a lot of different spaces. GDPR is got some great intentions, and it's actually well written in a lot of places. And I think that stronger control of user data is a good thing. But a lot of these discussions are going to be about jurisdiction. Yeah. And here at the EFF, we've argued for a very long time that it was bad news that the United States of America was able to impose things like the DMCA and its copyright law to the rest of the world. And there's a real risk in a lot of these new bills that are coming out or new actions that are taking place in China or in the United Kingdom, where everybody's trying to extend their jurisdiction out. I'm not saying that's how it will play out with the GDPR, but I do think that we're going to see more of these for less good intentions than this privacy regulation.
Tanny O'Brien, International Director of the EFF, thank you for helping us understand this. I get the feeling the whole world, at least Silicon Valley, is holding its breath to see what happens after Friday. But this is also, I think most of us understand, a very important discussion, balancing the needs of individuals and our right to be private and the needs for companies to monetize and do business and for the internet to work. And it's a very challenging problem for these three entities. And I think this is the beginning of a conversation that absolutely has to happen. Thank you, Danny. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Very nice to talk to you.
You know, it's something that we've been asking for the longest time, to hold these companies accountable for having our data. Well, this is how you do it.
This is what happens. We'll see. We'll see. It's going to be interesting. We're going to take a look at the 360-degree camera from a GoPro that Dale Baskin said not to buy, but I bought it anyway. Oh, that's me playing my tour of the Twit studio. You want to see that? I'll show you in just a little bit.
I can't wait.
I shot it with this. Ooh. Look at that. But first, a word from our sponsor, WordPress. Let me tell you, I love WordPress.com. I've been a WordPress fan forever. In fact, I'm not alone. 30% of all the websites in the world run on WordPress, and there's good reason. It's the best content management system, the best website generating and serving system in the world. But I, for a long time, I did it in my way. I ran my own server with the WordPress software on that. And then I found out, A, I'm paying more. I'm spending more time maintaining it than I ought to. In fact, I'm not blogging at all. When I found WordPress.com, I said, oh, this is, what a relief. For less than I was paying for my own server, WordPress.com hosts it, keeps it up to date, keeps it secure, provides all the plugins and themes you'd ever want. I love WordPress. If you're making a website, whether you're a business or an individual, the place to start is WordPress.com. It'll give you the freedom and flexibility to share your voice, your work, your way. It'll be your site. And you don't need to be a coder or a designer. No. They do all the heavy lifting for you. They give you all the tools you need. And should you ever have any questions, their customer support team is there 24/7, Monday through Friday, weekends too. And they're really nice, really great, really smart. They're responsive. They're what you want in a customer support team. You need e-commerce? WordPress has it. This is relatively new for WordPress. They have a, you can go everything from a single, you know, big buy button that works very well to a whole e-commerce online store. They've got it all. And prices start at just $4 a month. Now, I have the business plan, which gives me all sorts of great stuff, including some of the best plugins out there, Google Analytics, unlimited storage. But check it out. See which plan you like. When you're ready to expand your online reach for your business, they make it easy with built-in SEO, search engine optimization. You don't need some expert to do that. Let WordPress do it for you. You've got social sharing, which means your customers, your readers, will help spread the word about your site on their Facebook and Twitter. And, of course, all the plugins I use, you get HTTPS on every site. I love that. I use the Google AMP plugin to have my pages load faster on mobile. There's Akismet, Akismet's great, yeah. The best anti-spam filter for your comments. No wonder 30% of all websites run on WordPress. WordPress.com/NSS. We're going to get you 15% off your new plan purchase, but you have to go to that address. WordPress.com/NSS. WordPress.com/NSS. Thank you, WordPress, for hosting my site, leolaporte.com. For your support of the new screensavers. What are you doing there? You can't have my camera. Aww. You may not want it. So when Dale Baskin was on last week talking about the new 360-degree cameras, he said his pick, the DP Review pick, was Rylo, which is $499.
Okay.
But he also said, for image quality, the GoPro Fusion is unbeatable at the price of $699. Then I thought, well, I want better vision, video quality. I want it's 5.2K video quality. And I have plenty of 360-degree cameras, but that's usually what you sacrifice, right, is the quality of the video. It's a little smeary, a little blurry.
Which is fun when you just want to show it off, but then as you start going back through it, you're like, wow, this is really low-quality video. Right. It's all grainy. Right. It looks horrible in low light.
So now I got, and I also I have a kind of a love affair with GoPro. I've had many, many GoPro cameras. They're a great company. So I said, all right, I'm gonna spend the extra $200, spend $699 on the GoPro Fusion. You see, it's a 360-degree camera, two lenses, one front, one back. They're fisheye, which means each captures 180 degrees. And then GoPro provides software to stitch it together into a 360-degree video. You can view two ways. One, of course, on YouTube or Facebook, just as a video that you scroll around in. Or if you have one of those VR helmets like the Oculus Rift or the new Oculus Go or a Gear VR or a Vive.
Windows Mixed Reality, basically any VR headset.
You can then wear the headset and be in the scene, which is kind of cool. You can look around. I shot about a 20-minute tour of our studio. I just held the camera up and carried it around because I wanted to see how easy it was to work. It's like a GoPro. It has, you know, the LCD. In fact, I'll turn it on the front.
So if you've used a GoPro, you kind of
feel
know
very
how to
comfortable.
Operate this.
Yeah. Okay. And in like all GoPros, you know, you have to mix a variety of buttons to get through the menus and all that. It'll do stills, very high quality stills, 18 megapixel. It'll do 30 frames per second, 5.2K, or 60 frames per second, 3K, which would be good for action.
When you do the stills, are you limited to only 360, or can you say only use the front camera?
You can in effect. You have to use both. This is one of the things that's weird because it has each camera has its own SD card. So you need two micro SD cards. And the reason, just for speed, right?
That's
so each camera records to its own card.
Right.
So, yes, in effect, if you use just one card, you're going to get one camera's output. And the software will handle that, no problem. It also allows you to stitch it together automatically when you connect it up to your computer with the software.
Now, that's always been a weak point of all the 360 devices that I've played with, which is the stitching was weak. So you could always tell
Right.
Where that line was, where they joined the two different video streams.
This does an excellent job of stitching. So it has something they call overcapture, which lets you take any part of the 360 and make that be a traditional flat video, like a GoPro video. Okay. So if you're an extreme sports junkie, you can have that camera on your helmet, as you always would. And this, by the way, works with all the standard GoPro mounts. But you can say, just capture this part of the video. So you don't have to think about it as you're shooting, which I think is pretty cool. It has excellent video stabilization, a couple of different levels. That's nice, too. It does that in software. That's not in the lens.
There's no OIS stabilization.
As far as I can tell, it's doing it in software. But it does a very good job. It has voice control. You know, you can say, take a picture, shoot. GPS is built in. I like that. And that's, you know, it's a bigger camera. It has to have a bigger battery to run the... In fact, this gets quite hot. So you might not be able to run it for an hour or two solid, even though the battery life is
several hours.
So the GPS
is just for geotagging, or...?
Yeah, just as it would be for any camera, that it knows where you took a picture. You do have to use a fairly fast Class 10 micro SD card, so that's something to be aware of. Right now, GoPro is offering one free SD card with purchase.
wait, hold on. But you need
you still
two,
need another one. Yeah, I bought a package on Amazon that had both of them. It does come with, I think this is great, a little selfie stick like this. It'll expand out. And again, this is the traditional GoPro mount. And this is a great way. This is how I shot the studio tour video, because you don't want to be holding it in your hand. You kind of want to get the camera away from you. But what's also great about this, it turns into a tripod. You can use the GoPro software on your phone.
Well,
hello there, GoPro.
It's awake.
Yeah. You can use the GoPro software on your phone to capture remotely, which is nice. You can also use your voice to capture. I don't know what it is.
So you can preview on your phone.
Yes.
Does it show you the entire 360 frame?
You scroll around. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. So you know what you're getting, which is, I think, one of the great things about GoPro. A lot of complaints in the reviews, and I can't verify this yet because I haven't... I don't know what it's doing. It's talking to me. I can't verify it.
It's hungry for another card, Leo.
What is it doing? I don't know. Anyway, it's making noise. I can't verify this, but in all the reviews, people are mad about the GoPro mobile software because it requires you to log in before you can use it each time. That's a bad thing, because if you use one of these action cams, you're usually not anywhere near internet.
No, not even close.
So that is a disadvantage. I hope by now GoPro's removed this. I'll have to check that part out. I focus mostly on using it, you know, you don't have to have the camera, just recording. And I'll show you the recording. Now, this is the GoPro software on my computer, and it's frozen.
It's frozen.
It's frozen.
No,
solid.
It was doing this in the pre-show. Yeah. It just uses so much system resources, and this is not a weak laptop.
No, this is an i7. This has got a lot of RAM, but the quality is good, but we have put up on the YouTube feed, my personal YouTube feed, which is youtube.com/Leo Laporte. I put the render. Now, this is not going to be quite as high quality as the version that you would see coming out of the camera, because of course YouTube recompresses it, but it's pretty good. Now this is part of the studio tour. I'm just checking out what Megan's. Now let me show you. There is the GoPro in my hand. Okay,
now that's
the tripod.
Interesting view. Yeah.
So they do, as many cameras do. They clip it out. If I look up above, you don't see any gap. Let me turn the volume down so it's not distracting. In fact, it's very hard to find the seams. Occasionally, as you're moving around, you'll see a seam. But it's doing, I think, an excellent job of stitching.
It
ought to, because it took a whole day to render this 15-minute video. And that is one thing you should be aware of. I have a couple of problems. One, the GoPro software would not install at all on my Macintosh, and I tried several Macintoshes and several networks. I'm not really sure. By the way, as I move around, you'll see how good the video stabilization. I'm not really sure what the problem is with the Mac.
Well, handheld video always has that little bounce as you walk. And
right.
This doesn't.
It does a
like
very
that.
Good job of stabilizing it. There you can. Is that the camera or what is that?
It is.
I don't know what I'm looking at over here. Oh, that's.
Oh, that was Jason.
The only person tall enough to look right the camera right in its eye. He was right there. We'll go outside. But you see, there it is very smooth. It is very stabilized. So for extreme sports junkies, This is, and I think the image is quite good, even on the recompressed version that's
it
on YouTube.
It looks nice.
I think
the quality is
It's something you'd be pretty happy with in almost any case. As I'm walking down the hall, I think that's the best way to see the stabilization. I wasn't making any effort to hold this steady. Of course, a tripod shot's always going to be the best shot. This is a fun, this is a fun 13-minute tour of the studio you can see. And the nice thing about, in fact, it's something to keep in mind when you're doing 360 video. You want to have something to look at in every direction. And this is a good use for it because, you know, I'm walking around the studio, but you may want to look at something else. You may want to say, what's going on over there? What's this say doing? Or, you know, and so this gives you the chance to look at it in a variety of different ways. Incidentally, I was doing this during Security Now. And
I can see Steve on the monitor.
Steve talking. I don't think he noticed. But please don't tell him. So this is a chance for you to really, I think, see a good tour of the studio. And I'm pretty happy with the quality. I've tried a lot of 360 cameras. This is the best one I've ever tried for under $1,000 for sure.
But here's the thing. Look, GoPro cameras have always had nicer image qualities than a lot of the less expensive models. I mean, I still use them, but GoPro, they've got great sensors. They've got great glass. Is this worth the extra $200?
I'm a little, yes, if that's what you want.
If you want
I'm a little concerned about the software, to be honest with you. And I feel like, you know, GoPro's been struggling financially a little bit. And I feel like maybe
software always suffers.
Maybe that's the first thing to suffer. The fact that I could never install it on a Mac, I really wanted to run it. I have an iMac Pro, 10-core iMac Pro, with 64 gigs of RAM. It would be the ideal place to render it. It'd be the fastest way to render. I instead had to render it on this Windows laptop, a pretty good one, but it took a long time to render.
And that's a killer, because if you are one of these people who wants to take this outdoors so that you can share your latest adventure, to take 24 hours to render a 14-minute video, that's unacceptable.
Right.
You can't use that. That's
you have to be patient, I guess. Somebody's asking, do you need a gimbal? I would say you do not need a gimbal, that the software stabilization is so good. And that's a nice thing, too. You don't have to get extra hardware to make a gimbal. So for $700, you in effect, you're getting a gimbal-like experience. Here we're in the server room. And I think it's kind of fun that you can look at, and the quality of the, here's the deal. The quality of the picture is good enough that you can look at stuff in detail. You're not seeing a kind of a smeary image. You can really say, well, what's in that box? You know, what does that label say? What is that secret password that Leo's showing right now that'll let you into all of our Bitcoin mining operations? That kind of thing.
That's where Steve keeps his password.
Yeah. I'd be very careful about using this in a secure site. Let's put it that way. It's pretty good quality video. I've really got to ding him for the software. I tried to play this back on my computer because I wanted to show you the high quality. Nope. It just was unplayable.
One frame every 3 minutes.
It's there's a lot of video there, right? Yeah. It's 5.2K. There's a ton of pixels it's moving, and that's why I wish it worked on my iMac Pro. That really is. I have to ding them on the software. On the other hand, as usual with GoPro, where the software is a little bit laggard, the hardware is really fantastic. Mm-hmm. I think they've done a nice job, with one little exception. It's just a minor detail. But, you know, this is waterproof, by the way, down to 5 meters, which is great.
Okay.
Right? But you really want to make sure everything's sealed. And this, where you get into the micro USB, this thing fell off immediately, and I couldn't find it anywhere.
You're not sealing
that. And I
thought,
there goes the waterproof capability. Fortunately, I did find it. But just keep in mind, this thing is not exactly strongly attached onto here. So yeah, I'm going to dig in a little bit for that as well. Finally, and we mentioned this at the beginning of the show, there's no protection for these lenses.
Right.
You cannot put this thing down. Make sure you use the included case and when you put the camera down, because you're going to want to make sure that those lenses are protected.
And you really have to baby this because, I mean, the lenses protrude. There's no safe place to put this down.
There's no flat place to put them. See, they're going to stick right out.
Ugh.
And that's kind of a drawback. I love it that it works with all the other GoPro. If you have a head mount, a helmet mount, if you have a chest mount, any of the GoPro stuff you have, this will work with fine. It's the same exact, you know, traditional way of mounting things with this threaded GoPro screw, and it just comes right off. And I love it that they include the selfie stick and it kind of works as a tripod too. That's very convenient. You know, I think this is a very nicely well thought out system. I'm hoping that GoPro will fix its software and make it available on the Mac, make it work better on mobile, and maybe work a little bit faster on the PC. Nevertheless, I'm pretty happy, and I hope you. If you want to see more, go to YouTube.com/Leo Laporte and look at that tour video, and you can see the output of this and get a better idea of the quality.
You can play the game that I love, which is Find the Stitch.
Yeah, and then there are times, especially when I'm moving, that you could see the stitch. But here we are on a tripod, and it's live. And I don't. That's a pretty good.
That's a really good.
Pretty
stitch.
Good quality. You know, it's.
I mean, I can see where the stitch should be. I just can't really identify it. If I didn't know it would be there.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not bad. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
And we can use. I'm thinking we might want to use this for. You know, like this show would be great if you could see the show, watch what's going on as we're moving around. I didn't mention it has four microphones, so it has surround sound. And that is another thing that I think is really important.
That has to be processed properly, too, because if you're using a VR headset, as you turn, it needs to change the audio.
I understand why it takes so long to render. Yeah. It's doing a lot, and it's got a lot of bits, a lot of pixels to look at. So, you know what? Long render time, considering what you're getting.
Carry two laptops.
The Nokia 3D 360 camera, we shot a half an hour here at MacBreak Weekly. It took a week to render. So, yeah,
but Alex Lindsay has a trailer with servers built for that.
Yeah. It'd be nice to have a render farm.
That's not fair.
I will keep trying to get the Apple software installed, the GoPro software installed on my iMac Pro, and maybe I'll give you an update on it, if that makes a difference to have to throw 10 cores at it and a GPU and all of that. So it's hard to say, yes, this
it's
is a
better
must.
Than the Ricoh.
Better than the Rilo, yeah.
Oh, because you had the Ricoh.
Oh, it's much better than the Ricoh Theta S.
The quality is better than the Rilo.
Infinitely better. The quality is a little better than the Rilo. It's missing some of the cool features of the Rilo. With the Rilo, you can say, lock on this person and follow them.
In this one,
you have to do it in post with their overcapture feature. You still can do it, but you have to do it in post by hand. But I think for image quality, which is what I was looking for, it's hard to recommend anything at this price. There's nothing better at this price. So as long as you understand the limitations, I would say it's a buy. But I do understand why Dale Baskin was very hesitant last week to say, oh, no, you should get this one. They recommended the Rilo, and I would read their review for more in-depth. It's kind of fun. There you go. There's John Slanina. I invaded his office. He's
pocketed here.
You didn't even know about it?
Nobody did.
Oh, that's hysterical.
And release music on it.
Oh, my God. That's hysterical.
So we're trying to rip it.
Again.
Look at this.
Oh, DJ Burke.
Look at this setup.
Who's spitting the tunes at 12 and 6.
Isn't it fun that in something like this you can look around? It's like you're with me. And if you want to look at what Burke's doing, you can. If you want to look out the window, you can. If you want to see if Steve's noticing that I'm not there, you can.
When's and, Patrick coming back?
You know, I almost never want to know what Burke's doing.
Burke is always up to something. I'll be playing with this a lot more. I've had a lot of 360 cameras, but this is the best-looking one. All right, coming up in just a little bit, I have one more thing to review, which is another travel companion. You notice everything I show is for traveling. Excuse me. You notice everything I show is for traveling. This is the Skyrim Solus. But first, Megan Maroney with her outdoor gadget picks.
It's almost summertime, folks, which means we emerge from hibernation and toss the tech for a gadget-free season of fun in the sun. Just kidding. You can still go outside, but let's not be ridiculous and give up our tech. Let's just take it with us. I love my Amazon Echoes. I've got one in almost every room and a few extras. Theoretically, I could open the window and still hear my music and podcasts from my kitchen Echo or my HomePod when I'm outside in the backyard. But why not get an Amazon Echo device that's portable? For $100, you could get the Amazon Tap. That's the Alexa-enabled Bluetooth portable speaker. That works wherever you take it, as long as you're connected to a Wi-Fi network. But for only $65, you can get the iLive Platinum Portable Bluetooth speaker that sounds just as good and contains its own built-in Wi-Fi. It's going to respond a little bit more slowly than an Amazon Echo because it's not an Amazon Echo and it's only using Amazon voice services. But you can still use it to play all your music and your podcasts or your audiobooks and answer your questions.
Play music for a backyard barbecue.
The playlist, Backyard Funk Barbecue, from Amazon Music.
It doesn't have amazing sound, but it'll do as long as you're not an audiophile. As long as you're hanging out outside, you might as well harness the power of the sun for all your devices. We've seen solar backpacks, solar phone cases, and solar lights, all with varying degrees of usefulness. But recently, Padre let me try the new RealLink Argus 2, an outdoor camera designed to work on solar power. It'll also work on a rechargeable battery, but it's completely wire-free either way. The Argus 2 costs $130 or $150 with its own solar panel. I recently showed off the clever little Wyze camera that only costs $20. Here's what you get for the additional $110 besides just wirelessness. 130-degree field of view, that's $1 for each degree of view. Full HD 1080p resolution, Sony's Starlight sensor for night vision up to 33 feet, motion detection, two-way audio, support for micro SD cards up to 64 gigabytes, and a rubber waterproof skin. You can mount the camera and the solar panels outside with screws or a metal magnetic base. Have you ever wanted to jumpstart your battery, charge your iPhone, and pressure wash your car with the same device? Neither have I. But once I heard of a device that does just that, it suddenly seemed like an excellent idea. The Norshire is a portable device that includes a car washing kit, a power bank, and a jumpstarter for your car. Turn it over and it functions as a warning sign in case you're in an accident. So it's sort of like a thneed from the Lorax. You remember those? A thneed. It's a fine something that all people need. Padre and I took a look at the Norshire on Know How, and here is what we thought.
We have so many batteries that we've shown off on this network. This is the first one that actually had a pressure washer in it. That's kind of cool. Now, they say it's a 4-in-1. It's really a 3-in-1. I don't think anyone's going to use this as a warning light. But the battery, the jump charger works really well. The battery bank works really well. And the pressure washer actually works really, really well. And, you know, for $100, this is just about the same price as the other jump start capable battery banks that we've played with, except I also have the ability to shoot liquid at things.
What tech are you planning to take outside this summer? I want to try it too, because inside is for suckers. Email me at megan@twit.tv and tell me your favorite backyard gadget. I'm Megan Maroney, and I host iOS Today every Tuesday and Tech News Weekly every Thursday.
Oh, I don't know. Leo, were you looking for your next
gadget? Wait a minute. That's the dumbest thing I ever saw. It's a power bank, car starter, and power washer?
Power washer.
That
come on,
is
you
so
keep,
strange.
You keep
to
it in the back
those.
Of your car, and you can,
when are you
can jump start your battery and then wash your windows.
It's the strangest thing.
It is a little strange, but I like strange. I mean, I've seen so many of these battery banks. This was the first one that gave me something where I'm like, oh, okay, that's weird. By the way, it's really fun for water fights. Just saying.
Oh, I bet.
Just saying.
All right, we're going to do another review. I know you're getting bored of my voice, but here is something that somebody asked me to review. We get callers all the time who are travelers and want to solve this conundrum of how do you get high-speed data without paying through the nose? Of course, the worst way to get high-speed data on the road internationally is to just let your phone do it, because
people still do that. Like, they'll call up AT&T and say, I'm going overseas. I want to pay you $500 for what should be $20.
Well, that's different. At least they call AT&T. Oh. What you don't want to do is just go.
Oh, yeah.
Because you will have data roaming is turned on your phone by default, and that means it will roam, but you will pay the full rate. And that can mean literally, and I've seen this when the iPhone first came out, tens of thousands of dollars. So at the very least, call AT&T. And I have to say, everybody, T-Mobile, AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, they all have international plans now.
They do.
Which mean that you could often get a pretty good deal. Just use your phone. Now, what people used to do is they'd get to the country. Let's say they're going to Italy. And the minute they get off a plane, they'd buy a SIM.
That's what I do.
That gives them international data. The problem is you put that in your phone, unless you have a dual card SIM phone, which most people don't, it's going to replace your phone number, replace your it's like brain surgery in your phone. Suddenly you're going to be on that Italian carrier with an Italian number. And now the good news on that is data will cost you what it costs locals, which is usually less than even in the United States.
Yeah.
So that's another option. I like to keep my phone. What I always do is I put my phone, first of all, I should mention, if you have T-Mobile or Google Fi, you don't have to do anything. You have international roaming for free. But it's slow.
It's ridiculously slow.
It's 2G data. When I was in Japan and Korea, I found that the Google Fi roaming was pretty fast. The T-Mobile was unusable because I have two phones. I have a T-Mobile and a Google Fi phone, and I always take these for traveling. The good news is 20-cent-a-minute phone calls. That's not bad. A buck for a 5-minute phone call. And unlimited free international texting, which is what you're probably going to do the most of anyway. So if you already have T-Mobile or Google Fi, you may say, that's good enough for me. But most of the time, I want more speed. And you really do want data as you travel. As you're walking around town, I used to have to really remember where I was and bring a map with me. You don't know where the restaurants or the museums are. Now you just have, if you have data, you have Google Maps. You fire it up. You say, where's the best restaurant? How do I get back to my hotel? I often will drop a pin if we take a subway somewhere and I want to get back to the subway station. I'll drop a pin as we exit the subway station, and I can get right back to it. Having data is really nice when you travel. Of course, translators help, too. And a lot of the times, those require data. So I liked, and I just like to have data because I want to send Instagram pictures back and so forth. So we were looking for a device that would do that for us. A lot of times people will arrive. In fact, somebody who was on our Japanese trip, when he got to Narita Airport, he just went and he bought rented one of those MiFi cards.
Right. Yeah.
That gave him Wi-Fi through the LTE network. It was very affordable. He could connect up to 32 Wi-Fi devices. As with most of these Wi-Fi cards, battery life is not great. Five, 6 hours.
Yeah, you kind of need to have an external battery pack.
You can't get through the day.
No.
So it's compact, and that's the advantage. This is not compact. This is the Skyroam Solus, and this is another way to go. This you buy. Oh, you took it apart.
I took it apart.
Let me put it back together.
That's kind of my thing. I disassemble.
Actually,
things.
As long as we got it disassembled, I'll show you. You buy it or rent it before you leave. I bought it $149 out the door. You see, it has these replaceable batteries, which
you can
really
buy
like.
Those in every type of capacity from Amazon right now.
Yeah.
So I mean, you can go all the way from 700 milliamp hour to all the way up to 4,100 milliamp hour. Same size. The 18650. Is a standardized size, but they have different capacities.
So you could increase. I could actually increase the capacity. This I'm getting 16 hours of data.
That's great.
But you can also use it as a phone charger. So if you get low on your phone charger, it has a Type C port. I like it that it's Type C. I hate those micro USBs. And I can use this. This is how I charge it. So every night we'd get to the hotel.
So if it's Type C, will it quick charge? Will it take the higher voltage to?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah. I don't know. Let's get a Type C cable and we'll try it.
Yeah.
When you turn it on, there is a Wi-Fi button. Now, there's some weird things about the Skyroam Solus. So, $149, you do not pay a subscription fee. And I think that's really important. I don't want to be paying for data when I'm not overseas.
Right.
I want this to, you know, be in my backpack. When I get overseas, I turn it on. When I'm in the United States, I don't want to pay for it.
And so, that's, is there a SIM card? Or how do you activate
it's
this?
It's got some universal SIM card. I don't
so
know
like
how
an
it works.
eSIM type thing.
Yes, yeah, like 160 countries. You don't do anything. It just works. You should check and make sure it works in the countries you're going to. You have two choices. You can buy day passes, which are $9, or you can pay, if you're gone for more than, say, 10 days, you probably want to do this, for $99 an entire month of unlimited data. So when we went to Japan, we did $99 for 2 weeks. Here's one of the drawbacks. Only 5 Wi-Fi devices. And since it was 3 of us, and each of us had a laptop, a phone, and a tablet, we would have to do a little negotiation. Okay, would you log off the Solus now so that I could use
it? That's a weird limitation.
5 seems like too few, but anyway. It is very easy to use. Once you log in, it has the I won't show you, but it has the password on the back here. Once you log in, of course, your computer or phone remembers it. You carry it in your pocket. It's a little bulky. It does come with a carrying case, which is kind of nice. And I should mention, its own charger. And a nice adapter, too,
nice.
Which allows you to do USB
A
to Type-C. So if you want to charge, say, an iPhone, you could just plug your iPhone cable into that and charge it. So I like that. That all fits in the additional cost for the carrying case. It wasn't too expensive. So I got the carrying case because you are going to – if you have a purse, easy – if you have big, baggy cargo pants pockets, easy. But it is a little bit bulky. I mean, it's not a small thing. You're not going to want to carry it on your wrist like this.
Yeah, but I mean, I'll take a little bit bulky for the 16 hours of battery
life.
That's
it. I want to get through the whole day. And when I'm out and about, I don't come home after 5 hours. I stay out.
Well, especially since the batteries are replaceable. This is the first device where I've seen the batteries be
standard.
Isn't that
nice?
Because I can buy a pack of 10 of those things, just have them in my backpack, and if I need more power, just swap them right in.
6,000 milliamp hours. So that's a couple of charges of your iPhone or similar phone. You get great LTE speed. I found it to be, you know, LTE, especially in Japan, is as fast as home Wi-Fi. 120 countries. We're going to be going to Europe. We're going to 5 different countries this fall. Spain, Italy, Portugal, Malta,
Italy?
And Morocco.
Are you going to visit me, Leo?
I might visit you, okay. Yeah. So this is going to be a better test of this. But we found it worked quite well. And it's really nice to have this in your pocket. Mm-hmm. You know, Lisa was always saying, you got the puck? You got the puck with you? Make sure you get the puck with you. Remember, though, you're going to be paying for Wi-Fi. $9 a day is not cheap. You may get a better deal from your carrier. You should check that out. And you almost certainly will get a better deal if you buy a Wi-Fi device in-country.
Yeah.
$9 is a lot. On the other hand, the convenience for me is fantastic.
Well, see, that's my MO is when I go into a country, at most airports, like in Tokyo or Germany, you can buy a super inexpensive SIM card that will give you way more than enough data and text than I'd ever want. Not in Italy. Don't ever buy the SIM card in Italy at the airport. They gouge. It's like 100 euro. It's ridiculous. But then you go down to the square, St. Peter's Square, and it's 7 euro.
Right.
For the exact same
thing.
That's
another reason to have this is you don't have to think about it.
Precisely.
You just have it with you.
That's the nice thing about a device like this. I know how to get cheaper data, but this allows me to go from country to country,
very
and
convenient.
It just works.
Yeah. If you're only going to be in one country, no problem. If you're going to be in 5 or 10,
maybe
a little more complicated. If they're all in the EU, they do have roaming throughout the EU, but I'm not going to just be in the EU. I'm going to be in Morocco. This is going to be very handy for
Malta.
Me. I know.
I can hook you up.
You know the Knights of Templar?
I do.
Okay. I want to go to the secret catacomb. So my recommendation is, of course, shop around. There's a wonderful wiki, prepaid with data wiki. If you just Google that, you'll see it. And that shows you country by country where to get the SIMs, who has the best prices. And that's updated by travelers all the time. So it's a very useful. And you may find there are better ways, more economical ways. There is none more convenient, though. So I like this. I'm glad we bought it. But I do think you need to understand the ins and the outs. And you may want to do as Father Robert does. If you're just going to be in one country, probably is the best thing to do. Just buy a SIM somewhere. There you go. That is the Skyroam Solis.
Not bad at all.
S-O-L-I-S, Skyroam.com. All right, enough of me talking. Let's let somebody else talk. It's time for a call for help. Let's go to Cheltenham, Pennsylvania. Steve is on the line. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how y'all doing?
I am great. Steve, by the way, look at this Wi-Fi access point he's got behind him. That thing looks very powerful.
He's got the Marvel Universe hanging on his wall.
Wait a minute. That's not a Wi-Fi access point.
That's Mjolnir.
I was wondering where Mjolnir got to.
It exploded.
I thought it was destroyed. But apparently
really
Steve has it.
Yes, I have.
Steve, speaking of mighty objects, you're looking for something that can secure your network.
Yes, I have a lot of IoT devices. I have a lot of Hue lights, Nest cameras, Nest doorbell. I have like a lot of it. I mean, like actually 49 things.
Good.
I thought I was the king.
My man. All right.
I love looking at my Eero and seeing how many devices I have hooked up.
He adds Wi-Fi devices to his house just so the Eero count will go up.
But we know what that means. It means terrible connectivity, right?
Well, I added a Nighthawk mesh network extender, and that kind of alleviated, the congestion. I'm just worried about security. I have a Fing box on there to monitor the network for any intrusions or anything like that. And I'm just nervous that, Internet of Things devices aren't necessarily secure because of updates and things like that. So,
what's a Fing box, Robert?
Well, a Fing box is a device that you can put into your network, and basically it just monitors what's going on.
I've used the Fing software, actually.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
What devices are active? What ports are open? It's sort of like Nmap combined with a couple of other different tools. I consider it a very good starting point for you to at least know what's on your network and kind of have an idea of what it's doing. But
does it warn you? Will it give you alerts? Will it say somebody's on your network that you never saw before?
Right.
Stuff like
so
that?
New device plugs in. Thing will say, hey, there's this new device like generating that. Traffic. Did you want to do something about
oh,
it?
I like that. Yeah.
So, yeah. So you're using that right now. How do you like it? Is it giving you data that you can actually use?
When I first got it, for some reason, it seemed like the network got slow. But then they came out with some updates, and now it seems like it's running great.
Right, because by design, a device like that is going to interrogate the different devices on your network. That's how it does its
work. We're adding even more traffic to your burdened network.
Yeah. Precisely. So, but once it has sort of the baseline, it can back off, and it doesn't have to do that as aggressively. But here's the thing. I love devices like Fing. I love the software for Fing that you can run on your Android or iOS device. However, I don't consider it a security device. It's more of a network visibility device, which is not bad. It's fantastic. I love it for that. But you're specifically looking at a way to secure your network. This is not enough. You know, this gives you a very good starting point. But if all you have is the Fing, then it might tell you, oh, yeah, you've lost data. That's not good enough. The first thing I would suggest, something that we've done here both on Security Now and on Know How, if you go back to episode 190, set up the three dumb router design. This is something that was first suggested by Steve Gibson. Really simply, look at the devices you have on your network. Find the ones that are untrusted. So I would put all my IoT devices in untrusted. Then say the devices that might be trusted but verify, and then sort of the privileged network. So I'd have three routers connecting to one router. That's the router that's actually connected to the outside world. What that will allow you to do is to actually have more bandwidth for the devices that you have in each one of those networks, and it will allow you to separate that traffic so that, let's say, an IoT camera gets infected, it can't actually start going after your laptop or your iOS device.
Now, let me ask, Steve has mentioned also Ubiquiti's Edge Router X.
Yes.
And he says, and that's a simple, inexpensive $50 four-port, actually five ports if you include the PoE ports, router that does VLANs.
Correct. Same thing.
Give you the same kind of security.
Precisely.
So instead of buying three Wi-Fi routers, you could buy this and two Wi-Fi routers, perhaps, or three. I mean, you can have as many as you want, and then separate them. That will make them all unique. And there's a lot of extra stuff going on with this Edge Router.
Oh yeah, no, it's a great device, and it's manageable. This requires you to be. You're going to have to do a little bit of learning.
It's a lot of learning.
Figure out how it works. The nice thing about the three dumb router is, if you know how to set up a router, then you know how to set up the three dumb router setup.
Right.
That's actually more advanced. I would prefer that because it gives me more flexibility. However, there's one other component. That gives you a bit of peace of mind even before you run any software. But if you actually want to know what possible vulnerabilities might be existing in the devices on your network, I would suggest a software package you can download for free called Kali Linux. It's been around forever.
I have that.
Yeah, that is the gold standard.
That's the pen tester.
The pen tester. Just start aiming that at the different devices that you have on your network. And actually, that will tell you which devices should not be trusted. Maybe it looks at your IoT camera and says, hey, this thing hasn't been patched in 3 years.
It actually knows. Is that some software on Kali Linux, or is that just kind of how it works?
Basically, it will do a port scan, then it will interrogate the service on that port, and most of the time, especially on older devices, it can determine the firmware.
Oh, that's really
And if it determines
great.
The firmware, it knows how old that firmware
so
is.
So what do you do, Steve? You have Kali Linux on a USB drive, and you just boot into it, or do you have a dedicated machine that's always running?
I have a dedicated machine.
Oh, Steve knows
what
he's doing.
I love you, Steve.
You're just pretending to want to know the answer to this question.
This is incredible.
I don't know everything.
No, well, Robert does, I'm glad to say.
And my cousin, he's an IT guy. I bug him all the time, you know, to help me out. And
I love it that you care so much.
Yeah.
You may also find that Nighthawk has some capabilities
as well,
right?
In fact, I think the Nighthawk series, if it's high enough, you can actually mirror report, which would be my last suggestion, a tap. Mm-hmm. If you tap traffic, you can actually use Wireshark, which again is a free program, to see.
Thing.
Oh, you have it?
Of course he does.
Oh, my goodness. So, I mean, that's my gold standard. If I have all the traffic and I can see all my outbound,
I can guarantee that nothing is leaving my network that I don't want to leave my network.
Okay.
So it sounds like you've already done everything we want you to do, Steve.
No, I need to know from you guys.
Let me just ask why you're so concerned about security.
Because I listen to Security Now.
Oh! That'll scare the hell out of anybody.
Yes.
I want Steve has a new, I want Steve to do a new acronym. He said GAS, right?
Right.
And because I think that a lot of times we talk about security threats and what we rank them in terms of how severe they are, in terms of what a bad guy could do, but mm-hmm. we don't rank them as to how much you should worry. He says GAS stands for give a boop, boop. And if how much you should give a boop about this. And I think a lot of the things, like the Spectre flaws, which we have yet to see an exploit taking
advantage
of.
That's more of a bibbidi-bobbidi-boop.
It's a kind of like, well, yeah, it's severe, because if somebody does exploit it, they can do bad things to you. But do you need to give a hoot? No, probably not.
Not yet.
Not yet. We're still waiting to hear what these new Spectre flaws are, and I'm hoping Steve will talk about that on Tuesday. I imagine we'll have some idea what they are pretty soon. So it sounds like you're doing all the right things. I'm very impressed.
Okay, so one last thing I'm almost positive you don't have. You could.
Good luck.
You could buy yourself an Ixia box, which will run every possible exploit against your network. Those start at about $45,000.
Okay, he does not have that.
But
so it's
they're
like,
really good.
It's a pen testing box.
You turn it on and it destroys things. It's awesome.
Wow, that's kind of cool.
My wife is not going to let me do that.
Probably not.
That's really cool, though. I like it that such a thing exists. Yeah, it sounds like you're well set up. I think that you don't really need to worry. Damn. I don't even do most of that stuff. I mean, I just kind of.
I don't have a network. I just use floppies.
I'm not too worried. Somebody's just given us a link. Now I am worried that says that there are more than 100 strains of malware taking advantage of Spectre.
Yeah, I saw that this morning.
Okay, never mind. I guess it's time to worry. You sound like you've done a great job, Steve. And I'm really grateful that you listened to Security Now. Thank you.
I almost ran downstairs and got my Twitch shirt.
Right on, dude!
Twitch shirt and cap shield and Thor's hammer. We got something here. We got something.
Bam.
You have to come. You got to come visit the studio because you sound like the perfect audience member for Steve Gibson.
Actually, we've got an opening in know-how to replace Father Robert. I think you should.
It sounds like you got a lot of the knowledge already,
I think
Steve.
You should come out here.
A little bit.
What do you do for a living, Steve?
Actually, I'm a locomotive engineer.
Oh,
no.
Choo-choo trains?
Yes.
Do you drive them?
Yes.
God dang it!
Okay, Dick DiBartolo, you need to contact Dickie D.
I'm so jealous. What do you call it? Engineer for?
Locomotive engineer for the regional rail division here in Philadelphia.
He's an engineer.
That's the coolest thing ever.
Is that something you wanted to do your whole life, Steve? Like when you were a kid, I want to be an engineer.
I had a train set, but it was just an opportunity that came up.
That's so cool.
I'm going to try to retire in January if it all works out.
Somebody in your family says, no, you're not retiring, Dad. You're going to be working.
Yeah, that.
Nice to meet you, Steve. Thank
absolute
you so
pleasure,
much.
Steve.
Thank you guys so much.
Next time, wear your hat. Do you wear a hat? Do you wear a little train hat?
I'm known for, like, fedoras and porcupines.
Nice! Even cooler.
Yeah, he's got the style.
Yeah. Nice to meet you, Steve.
Thank you so much again.
Thank you for being here. This is why I love doing this. We have the best audience.
You run into the coolest people.
Our listeners and viewers are amazing. Every time I meet somebody, I go, what?
Well,
what?
If an audience member said, oh, I'm an engineer, I would think, oh, so like network engineer, electrical engineer?
Locomotive.
No, I run trains.
Engineer.
Yeah.
Nice. Megan Maroney will be filling in for Robert next week. If you have a question for Megan or me and you'd like to get on the show, we'd love to get you on. Here's how you do.
Need tech help? The new screensavers are here with answers. Email your tech questions to newscreensavers@twit.tv.
We're going to get to the mailbag in just a second, but first, rock god Jason Howell.
Hi. What's up? I'm Jay Bone, also known as Jason Howell, and I am here with the Art of Fawn. And this is kind of a new approach to MIDI controllers. I have like a standard keyboard controller at home. This, as you can see, is kind of in the shape of a guitar. It is a MIDI controller, but it's also an audio input and output interface. You can plug that right in here. Right now, it's plugged into my Mac, and I have it going through GarageBand on the Mac. I also have some of the Art of Fawn controller information over here in its own software. On the hardware itself, 12 frets here all along this touchpad. It's pressure and touch sensitive along the way. 6 virtual strings. Over here, these are the actual strings that you strum. This is like the strumming board. As a guitarist, you can pick this up and you can play it right out of the box. There's also down here some buttons that will transpose. It's almost like putting a capo on the neck. Many times, my experience, pulling in synthesized version of guitar sounds and then trying to play them on a piano, you get nothing even close to an actual sound of a guitar. The response just isn't the same. You don't play them the same. But with the Art of Fawn, because of the way that it's set up and the neck is set out for guitarists, it actually ends up sounding pretty convincing. If I touch this button, it will cycle through all of these different modes, and it might be easier to see this in the software that you see up here. As I'm touching those buttons, it's switching between these modes on the side. So you've got guitar mode, which is where I was at before, violin mode, which if I go over to GarageBand and pull up, let's say, my string ensemble, it's meant to be more like as if, you know, if I had a single violin patch, more like you're playing it with a bow. If I switch to the next setting, this is the piano roll, and this is obviously meant to be played with piano sounds. Each of these little areas is another note. And the way that it's set up, it's not totally chromatic. As you can see, it's a scale. It's a C1 major scale. But you can go into the actual software and program that any way you like. On the drums preset, as you can see in the software, it's set up similar to what we had on the piano roll before. Every single section on the neck of the board is a different sound. The next one is called Smart Strum. It kind of simplifies your chords. It's almost like you can't really play a wrong note. There's different pre-programmed chords on all of these different places. The next mode that I'm switching to is called slide mode. They say that saxophone is a good kind of representation of this mode. I didn't really get very good luck with that, but it is good for slide guitar. So the next mode is called electric piano tap mode. And I found that this is good for like a funky organ style music. And then finally, and this one's a fun one, this is the arpeggiator. It basically means that as I hold down more keys, it's going to repeat a certain rhythm, a rhythmic quality. So that's kind of a general sense of what the Art of Fawn can do. There's a whole lot of modes in there. As you can see in the Art of Fawn instrument editor, all of the modes are on the left-hand side, so you can jump to them quickly here if that's easier than doing it on the hardware itself. And then down below, you have all of these different presets that they've given you depending on what you're doing. So if you were to pull up a guitar for slide guitar, you might get better luck out of the sounds by selecting their slide lap steel preset, which kind of changes some of the settings on this side to represent some of those changes, or, you know, same for violins. And then you've got a bunch of presets here for keys, and they all kind of respond differently depending on the actual sound source material that you're channeling in from GarageBand in this case. I should also point out, I'll show you really quickly here, you don't need a computer to do this. There is an iOS app, so any iOS device. I have it running on a iPad here, but you can pull this in. This is the Art of Fawn app, and this will be your sound generator if you plug the Art of Fawn directly into your iPad. It's really easy to do, and you can use this as your sound generating device. And I had both good and bad results on some of the sounds that I found in there. Ultimately, I had a little bit more fun playing around with GarageBand and having a little bit more of that manual control in the desktop environment. So all things considered, the Artifon is definitely a different type of device for musicians who are looking for new ways to control their music in a MIDI studio environment. I think all things considered, you know, as a guitarist, I really appreciate how easy the Artifon is to pick up and play like a guitar. So that really opens up some creative avenues. Some of the things like the piano roll, just as one example, it's nice that it does it. I'm not sure that I would personally choose to use this to control my piano sounds all the time, but there are some unique ways, like some of those easy chord progressions to assign it and, you know, let you do a little bit more free-flowing writing with that, and you can get kind of creative with that, and I appreciate that about the Artifon. So overall, $399 for the Artifon. This actually started off as a Kickstarter and is now publicly available for everyone. If you think this is going to solve some of your studio problems, it's worth checking out. I would definitely recommend, if you have the chance, play around with it a little bit before you judge it, because it's easy to take a look at it and go, I'm not so sure about that, but honestly, it does open up some really interesting creative avenues, and it's worth spending some time getting to know before you make your decision. I'm Jason Howell, and you can catch me on the Twit Network, sometimes talking about audio products just like this, and also Android on All About Android, and a whole lot of other things here on twit.tv.
I do want a keytar.
It's kind of cool, right?
Yeah.
I was trying to jam on it, but then he told me unless it's connected to a computer, it actually doesn't make any noise.
Yeah, the computer's making the noise.
Yeah.
Do you play the guitar?
I play the oboe, which is like the guitar.
The oboe. Do you really play the oboe? I love the oboe.
It's great. But the problem is, if you don't continuously play it, you lose your embouchure.
You have to have your lip.
You start over.
Yeah. But the oboe sound is great.
It's very distinctive among all the woodwinds, which is why I did it. But then I found out it was a double woodwind, and those are really hard to play.
Yeah. Double means two reeds.
Double reed, yeah.
It's time for the mailbag. We have a special guest mailbag pusher in there. Wait, before you go all the way in, Patrick, I got to point out, see that tattoo on his arm there, right there? Look at that. That's Pink, my love, my drug. He was at the Pink concert last night.
In the pit.
And he got her to sign that in New York, and then he had it tattooed.
And you just asked him, how many times have you seen her? And he says, 12 this season.
This tour. The beautiful drama tour, which we were both at last night. Patrick, it's weird that I ran into Patrick not once, but twice. Yeah. Because Patrick's also the author of My Twit.
That's right.
Which is the best software that uses our API, is available on iOS, and is wonderful. And it's just weird. I ran into you. Yeah. And then I ran into you again, because there's a few people at this show. It's not, you know.
Yeah.
But what a great show, wasn't it, Patrick? Yeah. That was an amazing, amazing show. Anyway, he's our guest mail pusher.
Mailbagger.
Push it in, Patrick.
Patrick Digital Postman.
Has a good job at the fruit company these days. Yeah. And now we give you the secret envelope. Pick one. And the Oscar goes to L.A. Story. No, that's not that one.
I've got email one.
Start it.
And email one says, hello, new screensavers. I have a 2015 MacBook Pro, and I would like to get a 15-inch portable monitor. I really like the Asus MB168B Plus. That was mentioned on many Twitch shows, but the Asus site explicitly says it's not supported on the MacBook
Pro. Oh, drat.
I found many portable monitors that use USB-C, but I've been unable to find anything comparable for use with Thunderbolt 2, HDMI, or USB-3 from my MacBook. Can you help? Sincerely, Ryan.
You know, if you have an iPad, I use Duet on my Mac. With the iPad becomes a second screen. Unfortunately, Apple broke it with the latest release of macOS, but I'm sure they'll fix it. That's a kind of cool way to go if you already have an iPad. It's not as fast, but it's using the USB 3 and the Lightning bolt. It was designed by Apple engineers. It's kind of a clever idea if you're already carrying an iPad along with you. I have to say I agree with him on his laptop choice. The 2015 15-inch...
Well, it's got a much nicer keyboard.
That's the last good iMac.
Right.
It's the last good iMac.
If you actually want to use it.
That keyboard is awesome. I'm hoping in June Apple will say, mea maxima culpa. That's for your benefit.
Yeah.
Well, I'm very sorry.
Thank you,
we blew it, and we're going to give you a real keyboard.
Because they have a long history of doing that.
No.
No.
They have done it lately once. They did it with the Mac Pro. I'm hoping maybe this is a new, they've turned over a new leaf.
But Ryan, thankfully, we do have something for you to choose. And actually, you were really, really close. Because yes, the earlier versions of those screens did have some difficulty with doing Mac. They just didn't like Mac. However, the newest version of Asus USB screen.
You've been sitting on that all along.
This is their Zen screen. So it's the next version up. It works exactly the same way. It's got this cool little magnetic case
going on.
Yeah, the
case looks like the Apple iPad Smart case.
Oh, yeah, you know where it was inspired.
Yeah.
It is USB-C powered, but here's the thing. It's dual mode. So if you hook this up into a USB-C port that has the alternate DisplayPort mode, it will be a DisplayPort monitor.
Oh.
No lag, just a DisplayPort monitor.
Much better.
Much better. However, if you don't have that, and it sounds like you don't, then they actually include a cable that goes from USB-C to USB-A, and it will act as a Display Link monitor. Now, you can just download the drivers directly from the Display Link webpage, and this will work as a second monitor. Now, the nice thing is Jammer B actually used this on his MacBook Pro 15 when they did the Google event. So we know it works just fine. It's a little pricey. This is going to be upwards of $300. But you know, if you're looking for it, I haven't found one that's better. I really like this. Even compared to the older models, which are the ones that I've really shown off on Twit, this one is just, it's beautiful. Great viewing angle, great brightness, great color saturation. And the fact that I could use it with USB-C, USB-A, or DisplayPort, it's kind of a no-brainer.
Is that 15 inches?
This is 15 inches.
So with a 15-inch laptop, it would be like you had two full-size screens.
Two full-size screens. And this will do 1080p. They don't have a 4K panel yet, and unfortunately, I don't think they're going to be doing a 4K panel just because that's a lot of data to push over
the
USB.
Well, that's what I was wondering. Yeah. USB is not as fast. I mean, I guess USB 3
USB
is.
3, yeah.
So it's fast enough that you can have a pretty good refresh rate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I game on this thing. There
really?
Is no lag when you're using the alternate mode because it is just a DisplayPort monitor.
So if you have a modern MacBook Pro, for instance,
Precisely.
Or a modern PC with a DisplayPort over a Type-C, that would work with
it. But what I like about this is it will work with your older one through the Display Link mode, and then when you get a newer one, it will work through the DisplayPort mode.
That's a pretty good recommendation. Yeah. That's the Asus model.
It's their Zen screen.
That makes me feel... stomach went, oh. Email number 2 from Scott. I would like to buy my 10-year-old a 3D printer.
Ooh.
Wanted to know if you have any recommendations for a kid-friendly 3D printer. He says, my budget, around $500.
Okay, this is tough because the one that I would have recommended, they've gone out of business, so I'm not even going to mention them. But they were great because it was literally kid-proof, and it was protected. It was very easy to keep people safe. For that budget, the one that I would suggest, and unfortunately it's a little bit above the budget, is the Prusa, P-R-U-S-A i3, the Mark II. So but that's going to be about $600. But here's the thing. It's a kit, so you'll have to build it with him. But once you build it, it does auto-calibration. And that's the part that is most difficult for newcomers to the 3D market. Because if you buy like a mono price, which is what I suggest to some of our more experienced users, you have to be constantly calibrating that thing. Otherwise, the prints don't come out right. They get skewed. They get bent. They come off the plate. The Prusa is what all of those kits are clones of. And it will do a self-calibrating movement at the beginning of the print so that every single time, no matter if you've built it slightly out of whack, the print comes out perfect. It is an amazing machine. I know it's a little bit higher than what you were hoping to spend, but this is a kid-friendly printer that he can use even when he's become an advanced 3D designer.
Are we in a 3D printer winter?
A little bit.
Yeah.
We're kind of oversaturated. The people who are going to get 3D printers have gotten 3D printers. There are so many clones in the market right now that people are buying them, and then they have horrible experiences.
That's the biggest problem.
Right, because, I bought a 3D printer, but it worked once.
It's terrible. Yeah.
That's the nice thing about the Prusa. That is a great device.
Now, the ones you're looking at here use plastic PLA to make or something like it.
Right.
But there are other 3D printers that use different techniques. What do you think of those?
Yeah, so the extrusion technique. So that can use PLA or ABS or Jetty, all of the different types of filaments. But there's the stereolithographic printing, which I love, but it's crazy expensive, which is basically a laser shooting into a vat of goo that's light sensitive. And then it just sort of retracts the platform and it just builds itself up.
Wow.
The quality on those are fantastic, but it's an incredibly expensive process. Then they also have the laser sintering, which I'm going to check out tomorrow at Maker Faire, which is essentially 3D printing with a laser and a pile of aluminum.
Yeah, I've seen those. Those look really cool, but they got to be expensive,
they're
too.
They're also ridiculously expensive. In other words, there's a lot of technologies that are vying for the crown of 3D. What I would say is start with something like the Prusa i3, or if you really can't spend the $600, go with something like a Monoprice Maker Select Plus, which will run you $300.
Oh, that's not bad. But I mean, hard to use.
A little bit harder to use, right. He's going to have to learn how to calibrate it versus the Prusa, which is just insert the file and go. There's options. I would kind of stay away from the super cheap ones because they can do things like catch on fire.
Oh.
And I'm not even joking about that. No, seriously. We actually did have a fire testing
did
one
we?
Of these. I did. That's why I had to move my lab.
To the Roman Vatican?
No, to a trailer in the back of the campus.
Oh. You're going to love it when you burn down the Vatican. That's going to be...
Everything there is stone. It's all marble and masonry. It can't burn.
You know, that Michelangelo stuff's overrated. Don't worry about that.
It's funny. The last time I went to that house, this is a huge house. I kid you not. In its heyday, it had probably 400 people. Now there's 63 of us.
Oh, nice.
There are rooms in the lower levels that have probably not been opened for 60 years, 70 years.
Wow.
And I'm going in there, and there's artwork just like with drapes. I'm like, should we have someone check these out?
Wow.
I think we found, what's that? I forget his name. There's a beautiful painting down in the basement I'm going to keep in my room.
You get to pick? Go down in the basement, Father Robert. There's some artwork down there. Pick something for yourself.
That's exactly how they sound in Italy, by the way. Everybody. I've determined I don't need to learn Italian. I just use my hands a lot.
Talk like this.
And add that little accent.
You're going to pick out a sculpture. You're going to pick out a painting. You don't try not to pick out anything more than 500 or 600 years old. Okay, that's all I'm saying. Father Robert, we're going to miss you, but I'm so happy for you because I think you're going to be doing some really important stuff in the Vatican, besides burning it down.
You know I'm going to miss this place. I'm going to miss working with Twit. I'm going to miss our audience. This has been a trip, Leo. And you know what? Thank you, because you took a chance on a chat rumor 6
really?
Years ago.
You were a chat rumor?
I was Twit Army. I was just Padre SJ
Actually,
in the chat room.
I know how we found you, and it's really Tom Merritt gets all the credit, because you were on TNT as a call-in. I guess once a year they had a kind of a regular listener joins us event, and you were on it, and I was very impressed.
And then I was in the Bay Area for Interop, and I was just in the chat room, and you said, hey, we have Twit in 45 minutes. You want to be a guest?
Really? I did that?
I did. And I jumped
I never
in,
do that.
I jumped in a car with Brian Chee, because he was with me at Interop, and we just hauled ass from Burlingame to Petaluma.
It must have been meant to be.
It was fun.
I am looking forward to working with you in Rome.
Right.
That's
now,
all
see,
I can say.
This is not the end of me at Twit. It just means you now have a much larger service area.
It just means better access to pasta. That's all I care about. Hey, we thank you for being here. Check out our gear recommendation page. We have it, an Amazon page that is all the things we've used and recommended, including some of these printers. Twit.to/Amazon. Is that new? I didn't even... Yeah. That's neat.
I like that.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I guess we make a little money from the affiliate fees if you buy something there. These are all things, including stuff we just recommended.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're going to buy that GoPro Fusion, buy it there.
Or that Synology NAS that I love so much.
Yeah, or your Anova sous vide device.
Oh, and of course, there's that Anker battery that I love so much, one that power my laptop for the entire day.
Now, you're not buying my old gear, although you practically could be. This is all brand new. I just want you to know.
That link is actually to a third-party store. We just
like
sell
basement.
Leo's old stuff.
All right. Yeah. Subscribe to our Amazon Flash Briefing. We make one for nearly every show, and it's a great way to get new Twit content on your Amazon Echo. You just do it in your Amazon app. It's one of the Flash Briefing choices. Add Twit to it, and every day you'll get something new. Not long, but fun. We also have a great newsletter. If you want to know what's coming up on Twit, just go to twit.tv/newsletter. You can subscribe. No salesman will call. And if you stop getting it on May 25th, well, you know why. And finally, of course, if you want to watch us, honestly, have we even investigated? We don't know. It'll be fine.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
If you want to watch us do the show live, we do it every Saturday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200 UTC. You can tune in at twit.tv/live. If you do that, though, I invite you to join us in the chat room, irc.twit.tv. There are some wonderful people in there. It's a lot of fun. It's a great social event. And stay there if you're there now, because the Giz Fizz is coming up, and Dick DiBartolo has fun with the chat room every Saturday afternoon after this show. If you aren't here Saturday afternoons, oh, I should mention you could be in the studio live. We had a great bunch of people. Well, three.
We had Maximus. That's all we
Maximus
need.
Maximus was here. Awesome. Nice to see you.
And we had the number one Pink fan.
Uh-huh. Patrick, and Maximus's dad.
So Pincus Maximus.
Pincus Maximus. Email tickets at twit.tv, so we expect you, and we can put a chair out for you. We'd love to have you in the studio. If you can't be here live, if you can't stream it live, you can always get it on demand. Just go to twit.tv/NSS and download it, or subscribe in your favorite podcasting app, and that way you'll get every episode automatically the minute it's available. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time on
Leo's World, I think.
The new Screensavers. Bye-bye, everybody. Yay.